You know, as we follow the news or current events, whether that be, you know, on television or the internet or, you know, whatever way, the newspaper, one of the things that in the last year or over the course, especially the last few months, is the news is full of accusations of hypocrisy. It seems like that it doesn't make any difference which side is being talked about, whether it is a conservative position or whether it's a liberal or so-called progressive position, that there's accusations from one to the other that just go on and on and on about someone has done something, said something in the past, written something in the past, and that is different than what they now say, and that's hypocritical. And it's a pejorative that is just spewed out there, and with, unfortunately, with a high degree of accuracy in some cases, describing, you know, the way our society operates. And we see these accusations just being flung back and forth, you know, from one source to another. Thought I'd look up a few quotes and read you some short quotations on hypocrisy. I only recognize about half of the authors, but you may be familiar with some of these. First one is, a hypocrite is the picture of a saint, but his paint shall be washed off, and he shall appear in his own colors. That's from John Mason. The second is, a hypocrite is one who sets good examples only when he has an audience. That one's an anonymous, and that's one of those that I recognized as far as a contributor. The third is, oh, what may man within him hide, though angel on the outward side. That's from William Shakespeare. I think that's an interesting contrast, the way that he puts that. Another, nothing is more revealing of an age than its hypocrisies. And I think that's quite a comment on our society and our culture today. That's from James Laver. Scott Mayer has this to say, hypocrisy is the resin that holds the plywood of society together. That's a picturesque way of describing it. The hypocrite has not a living hope, but a lying hope and a dying hope. And that's from an author named Layton. And finally, this one, and I really like this one. I hope you have not been leading a double life, pretending to be wicked and being good all the time. That would be hypocrisy. And that's from Oscar Wilde. An interesting, play, counterplay there with words. This afternoon, I'd like to take, in the time that I have available, a look at what the Bible has to say about hypocrisy. And I want to thank Mr. Richards for writing a better introduction than what I had, because the song he led is something that about Joseph that I hope to explore a narrative in the last quarter of the book of Genesis about the life of Joseph and examine, you know, the thread of hypocrisy throughout the life of Joseph and the events that took place with him and with his family. But first, let's define what hypocrisy is. Dictionary.com says this, hypocrisy is the pretense, and that is a pivotal word. It's a pretense of having a virtuous character, moral or religious beliefs or principles that one does not really possess. There's an element of deception here. You're pretending to believe something or to be something or to aspire to something that you really aren't, that you really don't have. You're really not this way. Webster's dictionaries have this to say, defining hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is feigning, F-E-I-G-N. It's feigning to be what one is not or to believe what one does not. The false assumption of an appearance of virtue or religion. An antonym to hypocrisy is sincerity, the opposite of sincerity. A synonym is simulation. Simulation is not real. It's a simulation of reality. You know, it's an assumption of a false appearance. It's not the substance of reality. Hypocrisy denotes a false or insincere profession of goodness by one whose aims are selfish or whose life is corrupt. It's another way of describing hypocrisy. One of the observations that I had that in working on this that I'd like to share with you is this one. It seems like lies always accompany hypocrisy. I'd like to ask for your consideration in this, and I would appreciate any feedback that you might have. Can you think of any examples of hypocrisy that do not or have not involved a lie? And then the opposite question, the reciprocal question, is can you think of any lie that does not involve some kind of hypocrisy or hypocritical act or hypocritical position? I have not been able to think of one. And my wife Dee and I talked about this. And she said, well, what do you think about Satan in the Garden of Eden? Obviously a lie. But Satan, I believe, was pretending to be on par with God. You know, it says, you know, as he's described in Isaiah or in Ezekiel, you know, that he was going to be like the Most High. That was what he was aspiring to be, either be like or to supplant the Most High. So Satan was, in this sense, he was pretending to be a moral authority or an authority that he really was not. So, but if you think of any of those, I'd really appreciate the feedback on that, because I have not been able to, at this point, you know, to come up with a scenario where I can say that's definitely hypocrisy that doesn't involve a lie, and the other is true as well. I can't think of a lie that at some point doesn't involve some kind of hypocritical position. Another comment that my wife had said about an event that took place in their household, mother and father and four kids. There's something that's broken in the living room. So the parent asked, does anybody know anything about this broken such and such in the living room? No one answers. Well, of the four of them, one of them is explicitly lying and it's hypocritical because they know who broke it. The other three are choosing to, you know, disguise or to obscure the position of their position and the one who actually broke it. So in that sense, they're perpetuating or propagating a hypocrisy by lying by omission. They're choosing not to say, oh, that was so-and-so in the family that did this. I find that interesting, that you know, we can see the thread of hypocrisy even through something that in families we've all experienced that one side or the other. In this first part, I'd like to look at, as I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, hypocrisy in the life of Joseph in the book of Genesis. And I appreciate Mr. Richards leading that song. That was a great introduction. We had no collaboration or corroboration of that. And I want to try to take about 13 or 14 chapters of Genesis and compress those into a narrative that hopefully will just hit the high parts and emphasize from the beginning to the end of Joseph's life the thread of hypocrisy that affected him and that affected his family. And so I'm just going to start reading. I'm going to start in the 37th chapter of Genesis, and if you want to look through the scriptures as I go through them, I'm not going to call those out, but I'm going to basically, you know, pick out parts of the verses from this account from Genesis, beginning in Genesis 37. So here we go with this. Genesis 37. Joseph, 17 years old, he's the second youngest of 12 brothers, the sons of Jacob. He tells on his brothers right off the bat. He tells on his brothers by Bilhah and Zilpah. They're two concubines of Jacob. Those four brothers were Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. So he brings a bad report. He tells on these older brothers to Jacob. And that probably didn't endear him a whole lot with those four or with the rest of them. But that's, we get a glimpse of, here's the 17-year-old, and here's a little bit about the family dynamic. You know, and then to compound that, Joseph is Jacob's favorite son. He's the one that is the apple of his father's eye, so to speak. Probably without much tact at age 17, Joseph shares two dreams of his brothers, father, and mother bowing down to him. That didn't endear him to, uh, to anyone either. But there's an interesting expression in one of those verses that says, interestingly, however, Jacob kept the matter of the dreams in mind. And basically it implies that the brothers kind of blew that off. But Jacob had that recollection that, you know, he remembered, even though it was uncomfortable, he didn't like hearing it. Certainly a 17-year-old's presentation probably wasn't the best, but he remembered that. Joseph the tattler is sent to Shechem by Jacob to check on the other brothers and their tending of the sheep. He can't find them and is found wandering in a field, as it says in verse 15, like a 17-year-old without a plan. He gets there to Shechem or to that area. He's looking for the brothers. They're nowhere to be found. He gets advice from a man that the brothers have relocated to Dothan, another city. The brothers see him coming and begin to conspire. First, they talk of killing him. So there were some of them that really took exception to the way that he was conducting himself and the way what he had said and how he was looked at in the family. Reuben, the oldest, intercedes and plays for time, suggesting that they cast him into a waterless pit, which they do. The brothers sit down to eat and see a camel train of Ishmaelite traders on the way to Egypt with their wares. Brother Judah sees an investment opportunity and suggests making a few shekels by selling him to the traders. The sale for 20 shekels goes through while Reuben's away, and he returns and is upset to find out that Joseph's been sold and it's gone. The brothers then kill a goat and bloody up the tunic of many colors, present it back to their father Jacob and say, "Do you recognize this?" And then they lie by letting him believe that Joseph's been killed by a wild animal. And this is where the hypocrisy begins, that you've got, you know, the 10 brothers, you know, Benjamin being the youngest, and we don't have any record that I'm aware of as the age differential between Joseph and Benjamin, but Benjamin, the 12th son, was considerably the younger. But these other 10 pull this off. They hate Joseph. They hate the way he's treated by the father. They hate the position that he has in his father's eye, and they basically conspire to do away with him. And so they present this, and they allow their father, they do enough omitting and enough deception to allow their father to draw the conclusion that his favorite son is dead. And, you know, and Jacob is crushed. Jacob is just crushed by that. So this is where their hypocrisy begins. The Midianites get to Egypt, probably mark up the price, and sell Joseph to Potiphar, the captain of the guard and the keeper of one of Pharaoh's prisons. I don't know if Potiphar is a title or if it's actually a name. I'm not sure which that is. But anyway, this was a very influential position in terms of with his responsibilities and his accountability to Pharaoh. God greatly prospers Joseph, and before long he's running Potiphar's household and his business operations. There's a reference there to fields that Potiphar either owned or had the responsibility for as well. Mrs. Potiphar, as I'll refer to her, tries unsuccessfully to seduce Joseph. She catches him alone and grabs him. Joseph runs from the house, leaving behind an article of clothing. Mrs. Potiphar gets vindictive, falsely accuses him of making advances toward her. She makes this accusation to her husband. That gets her husband really upset. And he's very angry at that accusation, and he conveniently tosses Joseph into the prison that he's responsible for. That's his area of responsibility. So we see that Mrs. Potiphar projects innocence and virtue, deceiving her husband. Joseph's the one that pays the price. She's involved in another thread of hypocrisy. She's the one that was doing the lusting. She's the one that tried to do the seduction. But then when she was not successful, then she blamed that and reversed on Joseph, and then the husband chose to believe his wife. And so he tosses the slave into prison. Joseph's paying the price. Now she's a hypocrite. She's got this hypocritical operation in place. God blesses Joseph in prison, and before long he's running the show there. You know, Genesis 39:23 says that the Lord made Joseph prosper in whatever he did. So whatever the circumstances were, and he's been already involved in a couple of extremely difficult, life-threatening type circumstances, but God, and as we sang in the song, you know, God was always with him. You know, God, as 39:23 said, made Joseph prosper in whatever he did. Joseph then meets Pharaoh's chief baker and chief butler, with whom Pharaoh's had a falling out, and is tossed into prison. This is the same prison that Potiphar runs where Joseph's incarcerated. Chief baker and the chief butler have dreams which Joseph interprets with God's guidance. After the interpretation, he asks to be remembered by the chief butler, who promptly forgets when both dreams are fulfilled. Chief baker is hung. Chief butler is restored to his position. Joseph's still stuck in the prison. 2 years go by. He's still in prison. 2 years go by, Pharaoh has a couple of dreams. One about fat and lean cows, the other about seven good heads and seven thin heads of grain. No one in Egypt can interpret what those two dreams mean. The chief butler has an aha moment and remembers Joseph's interpretation of his dream from 2 years back. Pharaoh sends for Joseph after the chief butler brings that out to the Pharaoh. He sends for Joseph, who with God's guidance interprets those two dreams. This leads to an immediate promotion out of prison for Joseph to the number two rulership position in Egypt. He gets fancy clothes, he gets jewelry, and he gets a wife who is the daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On. So he goes from being a prisoner to the number two rulership position in the land of Egypt, the kingdom of Egypt, with accountability only to the Pharaoh. Quite a change of circumstances for Joseph. Can you imagine the scene at Potiphar's house when he gets home from work and Mrs. Potiphar asks, "Honey, how was your day?" Potiphar answers, "You're not going to believe this, but remember that Hebrew slave that made that pass at you that I put in prison? He's running the country now." You know, he's second only to Pharaoh. I wonder how they felt then. Did they think Joseph would retaliate? Because now the tables are turned. He's in the number two rulership position in the land with, you know, as immediate access to Pharaoh as probably anyone, you know, could have. Did Mrs. Potiphar's hypocrisy continue, or was it resolved? You know, we're not told. The text doesn't say. We don't know if they worked that out, or if that caused them further issues or further grief or whatever. But that thread of hypocrisy, in that sense, came to a conclusion. But we're not told how that turned out for Mr. and Mrs. Potiphar, to use that term. At this point, Joseph is 30 years old, as it says in 41:46 of Genesis. So he starts out, you know, at age 17 when the account begins, and all of these things have happened to him. He's 30 years old now. He's sitting on top of the world, so to speak. He's been in Egypt for 13 years. Joseph's plan to take 20% of the food crops for each of the seven good years works well and pays off, you know, during the 7 years of famine. Famine is severe not only in Egypt, but also in the land of Canaan, where Jacob and the 11 brothers are living. Jacob hears that there's food in Egypt and sends all of his sons but Benjamin, Rachel's only other son, to buy food. The 10 brothers go down there. They encounter Joseph, who recognizes them and understands their conversation, even though he's chosen to speak to them through an interpreter. It's obvious at this point that Joseph's fluent in Egyptian because he's speaking to an interpreter with and through that interpreter to his brothers. But he understands, and you know, every word that they're saying in their conversations with each other, which they believe are private. Joseph takes the tough guy approach with his brothers, who do not recognize him. Joseph remembers his dreams from age 17, and then he accuses them of being spies. Genesis 42:11 says that the brothers describe themselves to Joseph as, "We're honest men. We're honest men." And there's Joseph, number two ruler in the land of Egypt, that knows exactly what they did to him and how he got to where he is at that point in time. But they're representing themselves. "We're not spies. We're honest men here." And this is after perpetuating the lie that Joseph's been killed by an animal and letting their father Jacob believe that now for 20 years. 13 in that from 17 to 30, and then, you know, we're at the beginning indistinctly. We're not sure if this is right at the beginning of the famine or if we're into the famine a little bit. But at least we've completed the seven good years. So that's 20 years that they've let Jacob suffer with the belief that his favored son is dead. You know, their hypocrisy sustains the lie to cover their hatred, their anger, and their action with Joseph some 20 years back. Joseph tells them in Genesis 42:19, and this is a quote, "If you are honest men," end quote. And he prefaces his instructions or his wish to them with that, "If you guys are honest, then here's what I want. And that is, I want you to prove that you're not spies by sending one brother back to Canaan and fetching the youngest brother who's back there to confirm your story." That was Joseph's initial position. He puts the brothers in prison for 3 days, then he changes his mind. He sends them home to Canaan, but he binds and keeps Simeon. Now, Simeon and his brother Levi were both Leah's sons. They had a reputation for cunning and ruthlessness. When their sister Dinah was violated, and that account is in Genesis chapter 34, they scammed the suitor Shechem and his father Hamor to be circumcised along with all the men of their city as the precondition to marrying their sister Dinah. Then on day number 3, after the circumcision had been done, these guys are all recovering from that procedure. Simeon and Levi go to the city and kill every man in the city with their swords. And further, in Genesis 49, when Jacob is blessing each of his 12 sons, he has this to say about these two brothers, Simeon and Levi, that Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling places, and their anger is fierce and cruel. You know, their actions were hypocritical. They were presenting themselves to Shechem and to his father Hamor that, hey, we can work this out, but, you know, we have to have, it's not going to work if you guys don't commit to the custom that we expect, and that is we expect, you know, that you are going to be circumcised. And so they did that. But basically, what Simeon and Levi did with their cruelty is they were disguising their intent to kill everybody in the city, all of the men. And that's what they did. Their hypocrisy played out there, and it cost whatever number, an undetermined number of men, their lives. They planned that murder. They had the pretense of a resolution and of working something out, but in their hearts, the reality was they were killers, and they planned and executed the murder of all those men. Back to Joseph. Joseph plays a trick on the brothers by returning their money surreptitiously, and the response is, quote, "What is this that God has done to us?" End quote. You know, that's what their expression is when one of them opens his sack for whatever reason. I think he's going to feed his donkey. And then there's this money laying there in the mouth of the sack that they had taken from the land of Canaan down to Egypt to buy this stuff. And so they're really concerned about that. But they're saying, you know, what is God, why has God done this to us? All are afraid when they find their money in the grain sacks. The brothers recount their trip to Jacob again, saying, "We told," and they referred to Joseph as, since they don't know him, as the Lord of the land, that "we told the Lord of the land, we're honest men." They're standing there in front of their father that they've deceived for 20 years about Joseph's death, and they're saying, "We're honest. We're honest guys." Still living the lie. Still perpetuating that lie. That hypocrisy is still extant. It's still in process. It's still in progress. Jacob laments to them that Joseph is no more. Nobody says, "No, wait a minute, Dad. You know, we told you wrong back there." Nobody says anything like that. Jacob laments that Joseph is no more, and then Jacob says, "And neither is Simon or Simeon." Now Simeon is no more, and Simeon was still alive; he wasn't killed. But Jacob is upset that he's facing what he believes the very real possibility he's going to lose another son. That here's one of them that didn't come back from the trip to Egypt; he's still in prison down there. And Jacob says, now you want to take Benjamin to Egypt? Is this how this is going to work out? And so they, you know, Reuben pledges the lives of his two sons, Jacob's grandsons, if Jacob will just relent and let Benjamin travel with him. That apparently was not successful because a little bit later, Judah pledges himself as surety for Benjamin. It's quite a bit lengthier account of that, and all of the things that Judah said, he's willing to become surety for that youngest brother Benjamin. They use up the food. It's time for another trip to Egypt for replenishment. So they finally, Jacob relents and agrees to let Benjamin travel with him after Judah has pledged surety for him. And the brothers head back to Egypt on trip number two. They take back their original money, which was Jacob's suggestion, and then they take back double of what they brought the first time. Jacob suggests a present to the Lord of the land, as they referred to Joseph, not knowing who he was. And so they take some pistachio nuts and some almonds and some other things as a present to Jacob. And that's intriguing to me because I think you're in the middle of a famine and you've got pistachio nuts. You know, I'm thinking, well, how bad can that be? Well, it must have been bad because you're not making bread out of pistachio nuts and almonds, I don't think. But in any case, they came up with what sounds like a smaller present to take back to the Lord of the land, as they referred to him. The brothers meet Joseph again, who tells the steward of his house to prepare a noon meal for them. They're afraid and they suspect a trap that will lead to their enslavement. They explain to the steward about finding their money in their grain sacks. And the steward tells them to relax, not be afraid, and he says that the God of your father has given you the treasure in your sacks. And then there's a short little quotation that's exquisite. And he says to the brothers, I had your money. I had your money. There's no record of what the brothers, whether they responded or how they responded when the steward said that. At this point, Simeon is released from the prison, and he rejoins the rest of the brothers for this, for this really sumptuous meal. Joseph's overcome by emotion at the sight of his younger brother Benjamin prior to them eating, and he leaves the room until he can compose himself. Then he returns, and they have a great meal there with Joseph and the 11 brothers. Joseph is seated separately from the brothers as a group because for some reason it's an abomination or was an abomination to the Egyptians to eat with Hebrews. And there's no clarification that I've been able to find beyond that statement that it was an abomination to them. They didn't like that. For some reason, and this you'd have to look at it through their eyes, Benjamin is served five times the amount as the other brothers. So it'd be curious, we're not told in the text what the other brothers thought of that, but there must have been some curious glances. What's little brother doing over there with five times the food that the rest of us are getting? What's that all about? We're not told in the text, but you have to think about, a gathering like that with the number two ruler in an empire there, and he's hosting this sumptuous noon meal with his 11 brothers, and then you see that behavior, the separation, and then the treatment, the special treatment of Benjamin. Joseph sets up another trick on the brothers by giving orders to the steward to put each brother's money back in their grain sack, and then to put Joseph's special silver cup into Benjamin's sack. And the steward does that. At dawn the next morning, the brothers hit the road back to Canaan with their donkeys loaded. Joseph sends the steward after them with an accusation that they've stolen from Joseph. The brothers profess their innocence again. They're horrified and they are just incredulous that they're being accused of this theft. Joseph's accusation and their response to me is the opposite of the hypocrisy that they exhibited to Jacob about Joseph. Now the tables are kind of turned. It's almost like that Oscar Wilde quote that Joseph is deliberately taking and this position and playing a trick on him because he knows the whole story. He knows who they are. They don't recognize him. He knows exactly, remembers exactly how he wound up, you know, in Egypt, all of the things that befell him, how God was with him from age 17 to age 30-something at this point. The brothers tell the steward that they're not thieves. We're honest guys. We're not spies. We're not thieves. And that they brought back, you know, remember, we brought back the original money that was put in our sacks. We expected to get that back to you. They exclaimed that whoever took the silver cup ought to die. And that if it's found with them, that they'll all be slaves of the Lord of the land. And so, I mean, they kind of go to the other extreme. They're incredulous, and they say some things rashly here. Steward tells him he'll just take the one in whom the silver cup is found. That will be the one that'll be the slave. Now, the steward knows the whole story as well because he's under Joseph's authority, and Joseph has told him what to do here. You know, you've got to imagine that the brothers are feeling pretty good as the process gets started. You know, the steward starts at the oldest, and he's working his way down to the youngest. So I would imagine, depending on the size of those grain sacks, if the steward had, you're not going to dump it out, I don't think, but he's poking around in there, seeing if anything is touching a silver cup. You know, and so Reuben's off the hook. He's working his way down. Hey, we're down to number 10, and you know, things are looking pretty good. And then the steward gets to Benjamin's sack. He opens Benjamin's sack, and there is that silver cup. And so the brothers, at that point, are horrified. You know, they realize that, you know, that this is an extremely serious situation for them. Because the steward has said, I'm just going to take as a slave the one in whom the silver cup is found in his bag. So the brothers recognize, oh, we just lost Benjamin. We just lost Benjamin. So then they go back to the city, it says, to face Joseph. Judah starts out and he entreats Joseph and recounts how special Benjamin is to their father Jacob, since Joseph is gone and presumed dead. Ironically, Judah repeats the lie unknowingly to Joseph. He's recounting the hypocrisy that's taken place, you know, 20-something years ago to the man who was affected by it, the principal one, you know, that bore the brunt of that hypocrisy. So he goes through that, you know, that here's how much Benjamin means. He's the son of our father's old age. He's the youngest. His older brother was the favorite. He's gone, and presumed dead. He pleads with Joseph, going through the expected impact that this news is going to have to Jacob, saying that Jacob, our father, is going to die when he gets this news. And if we show up and Benjamin's not with us, that is going to kill our father Jacob. You know, Judah at that point then offers to remain as a slave in Benjamin's place. You know, he's going to, you know, to live up to his offer as surety for his brother Benjamin. What an interesting turnabout from Judah advocating selling Joseph into slavery, and now he's offering to be the slave of Joseph. And I imagine in Joseph's mind, those dreams resonated when the brothers are, as he dreamt, were going to bow down to him. And there was, I would imagine, there was some serious bowing and scraping going on, you know, in some of these meetings with Joseph, unrecognized as the brother who was the lord of the land in the number two position in Egypt. So quite a turnabout from Joseph, you know, offering and you know, or offer, not Joseph, but from Judah, basically making 20 shekels on the deal of selling his brother to the Midianites or the Ishmaelites, as they're referred to both ways. At this point, Joseph can't restrain himself in the charade any longer. He orders all the Egyptians out of the room, and he reveals himself and who he is to his 11 brothers. To say they are incredulous is probably an understatement. Probably an understatement. The celebration gets loud that the Egyptians who are outside hear about it, and even the Pharaoh hears this, whether that was literally heard the noise of exultation the things that they were saying to each other and what they were doing, or whether it was just told to him. But even the Pharaoh hears about it. Joseph tells the brothers to return to Canaan to Jacob and to move the entire family and their holdings from the land of Canaan down to Egypt. He tells them that there's still 5 years remaining in the famine. So here we are, you know, and he says that in Genesis 45:11. You know, Pharaoh is told about this, and he confirms that, you know, that Joseph's plan is acceptable to him to move the whole family down. He says you can have the best of the land. You pick it. You pick where you want to be, your choice of the area in Egypt that you wish to settle. And Pharaoh has not forgotten the contribution that Joseph made in the interpretation of those dreams and the result of those 7 years of plenty, and then here they are 2 years into 7 years of famine. And they know it's not open-ended because of God's guidance in Joseph interpreting that dream that says, you know, it's seven and seven. And so they know what to expect. Pharaoh even goes so far as to provide carts to Joseph and his brothers so that their wives and their little ones and the stuff that they had can be more easily moved down to Egypt for the trip. Joseph sends gifts back to his father Jacob and gives gifts to his brothers, but he gives much more to his brother Benjamin. The brothers arrive home in Canaan and fess up to their father Jacob that Joseph is alive and is the governor of all of Egypt. Can you imagine what that trip home was like? I would imagine there were some serious conversations around the fire, if they had one, as to how and who would tell Jacob about their hypocrisy and the lies that they had perpetuated for about 22 years at this point. You know, we know that from 37:1-2, that Joseph was 17 at the start. He was 30 years old before the 7 years of plenty started, followed by the 2 years into the famine. So this hypocrisy has been extant for 22 years in that family. And those brothers chose initially, and then they chose to continue this position that your son Joseph was killed by a wild animal. And they let Jacob stew and mourn with his grief in his loss, or what he perceived as his loss. At this revelation, Genesis 45:26 says this, quote, "Jacob's heart stood still." Jacob's heart stood still. That "stood still" is a quote. Stood still at the disbelief of what they told him. What an incredible thing to be told that we lied to you 22 years ago. Your son Joseph has been alive all of this time, and you wouldn't believe the position that he's in now. 45:27 says that, you know, when he was told about all that they saw and what, you know, they, you know, what they experienced, you know, with Joseph, that Jacob's, quote, "spirit revived," end quote. His spirit revived. They recounted all of those things. And then there's also when he saw all of the carts that had been made available to him by the Pharaoh for the move to Egypt. So what an incredible shock for the father to see and to go through that, the effect and the result of the lies and that hypocrisy that those 10 brothers, you know, executed on their father. Genesis 46, God speaks to Jacob in a vision of the night and validates that it's his will that Jacob and family move to Egypt. It's really an interesting inset right there, as you think everything is really sailing along smoothly, and then we're instructed here where we see the text of, you know, God appears to Jacob in a vision of the night, as it says, and he validates that it's his will that Jacob and his family move. You have to wonder if Jacob was conflicted about the move because of what God told him back in Genesis 35, verse 12. And he said, he gave the land of Canaan to Abraham and Isaac, and he was giving Jacob and his descendants the land of Canaan. So you have to wonder, or we wonder, if Jacob is having some doubts as whether he ought to move, even though it's a convenient thing, it appears physically that it's going to be a great move because that's where the food is. And Joseph's influence is going to be tremendous in its benefit to the family. But in his mind, you have to wonder, now God told me that he gave this land of Canaan to my grandfather Abraham, to my father Isaac. He told me in 35:12, he's given it to me and my descendants. So is it correct for me to leave? So you have to wonder if that's what this was all about. God tells Jacob that he will make a great nation of his descendants in the land of Egypt. That's part of the vision of the night, as it's called. He tells Jacob that he'll bring him back from there. Adam Clark's commentary mentioned that there's doubt that Jacob would have moved to Egypt without God's validation. That also Genesis 26 in verses 1 to 6 mentions that God told Isaac during a previous famine. He said there was a famine, an earlier famine in the days of Abraham. There was a second famine that affected Isaac. And he said during this previous famine, God told Isaac specifically, don't go to Egypt. Do not go to Egypt. So Jacob, depending on the ages of when that took place, could have been old enough to have said, hey, God told my dad explicitly, don't go down to Egypt. So, you know, in looking at those things, you have to wonder if Jacob, you know, how he felt about this impending move. God told, you know, back there in 26, he said, told Isaac to dwell in the land and that he would give it to him and his descendants. But in any case, that God validated that this is my will. You know, God is saying this is what you should do. And here's what's going to happen. You're going to be brought back up, you know, from the land of Egypt after you die. You're going to be back in the land of Canaan in that sense, but it's okay for you to go. Jacob's 66 extended family members moved to Egypt to join Joseph, his wife, and their two sons who are already there. And that adds up to the 70 souls, as it said, that moved from the land of Canaan down to Egypt. Joseph instructs his brother to tell the Pharaoh, when they're asked about their occupation, that they're shepherds. For some reason, shepherds were an abomination to the Egyptians. We're not told why in the text, but that was the position. You know, just my speculation, was this a mechanism to maybe have a little bit of separation from the Egyptians? That we can be in the land of Goshen. It's, again, this is just speculative because the text doesn't say this. But you wonder, why did Joseph coach them to tell the Pharaoh, we're shepherds, parenthetical thought, and this is an abomination to the Egyptians? You know, we can only surmise that there might have been, you know, an objective to have a little bit of space and a little bit of distance from the influence of the Egyptian culture. You know, we're not told why. Pharaoh offers the land of Goshen to Joseph and his extended family. And then Joseph introduces Jacob to Pharaoh, and Jacob blesses Pharaoh. That I find that particularly interesting because, you know, when we get into the book of Exodus, we see different pharaohs and a totally different behavior, a totally different reception of the children of Israel at that point. This point in time in the narrative, Jacob is 130 years old. He's 130 years old. Joseph continues to administer throughout the famine after the Egyptians' money runs out, that they were using to buy back the grain. Joseph takes their livestock in payment. When the livestock is exhausted, Joseph takes their land as payment. And essentially, this plan that he executed converted the Egyptian culture, with the exception of the priests, to a sharecropper society. And the deal was that the Egyptians tilled the land. The priests, again, were accepted. The Egyptians tilled the land. They gave Pharaoh 20%. They kept 80% for themselves. Jacob lived in Egypt for 17 years more after the move, and he died at age 147, as it says in Genesis 47:28. Before he died, Jacob made Joseph swear to bury him in the land of Canaan at the burial place that Abraham had bought, going back to his grandfather in negotiating and buying a burial place for Abraham and for his descendants. But there's some time spent on that in terms of the detail and the importance of that to Jacob and the binding agreement that he had Joseph swear that this would be done and that Jacob would be returned to the land of Canaan, to the burial place that his grandfather had bought. Jacob then blesses Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, announcing to Joseph that they're now considered Jacob's sons. And he makes an interesting statement in that verse. He said, now any other offspring, those are going to be yours. But Ephraim and Manasseh, They're mine. They're to be considered my offspring. Jacob then, in Genesis 49, blesses each one of his 12 sons, with Judah and Joseph receiving a much more extensive blessing in that 49th chapter. Jacob then died, and with Pharaoh's approval, Joseph and quite an entourage take Jacob to the burial place in the land of Canaan. They mourn him, and they bury him in the cave in the field that their grandfather Abraham had bought. Here we are about 44 years after Joseph was sold into slavery. My arithmetic could be suspect here, but and this is approximate because some of these events, we don't know, you know, how much time elapsed between, say, the time in prison and then the start of the famine, you know, whether there was any time there or it was just one, you know, very sequentially and serially after the other. But 44 years approximately after Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. He's 17 at the start, 30 when he was promoted by Pharaoh. Then he's got 7 years of plenty, 2 years of the famine when they move Jacob and his family down to Egypt, 5 more years left on the famine, and then Jacob lives in the land of Goshen for 17 more years after that. That makes Joseph at this point about 61 years old. After Jacob's death, the brothers fear that Joseph may take retribution on them for the evil that they did to him. Now that Jacob is no longer on the scene, there's no ameliorating influence here at all or moderating influence with the family. So the brothers are now thinking, wow, with the power that he has, if he's vindictive, we're in trouble. And they fear that he may, you know, take retribution. They're still dealing with the effect of their hypocrisy. They're still in the midst of that. It's still there in the family. Genesis 50, verses 16 and 17 says that the brothers then, after Jacob had died, was buried, the brothers sent messengers entreating Joseph to forgive their sin and the evil that they did to him. They asked Joseph for forgiveness, and Joseph grants it. He reassured them that he's not about to be vindictive. The 10 brothers claimed that Jacob had left a command to be given to Joseph, that Joseph was to forgive their sins against him and that the evil that the brothers did to him. What's interesting is that it's not recorded in the text. So we're left to wonder, did the brothers haul off and lie again? They're saying, Daddy said, you know, you're not supposed to get even with us. Is that what they did? We don't know. The text doesn't say. But the one thing we know for certain, at least from what I could find, I can't find a place in the book of Genesis from 37 forward to 50 where that it says, and Jacob said, and then goes through the instructions. Remember the very detailed instructions that he gave to Joseph and made Joseph swear, when I die, here's why I want to be handled. I want you to swear to me that you're not going to leave me here in Egypt, that you're going to move me back to, you know, and bury me in the land of Canaan. So it's a little bit hard to believe that there would be the omission of recording of instructions like this. But I guess it's possible. But in any case, the brothers are still worried until Joseph says that, you know, that he's not going to be vindictive. Finally, the hypocrisy in that family is finished. Joseph lives about another 41 years, and he dies in Egypt at age 110. So finally, there's resolution there when they petition Joseph for forgiveness, and he gives them forgiveness, and that's the end of that episode. But the amount of time that was extant, I find amazing. And the effect that hypocrisy had on all of those individuals, I find that just truly amazing. The time that I have left, I'd like to turn forward to the New Testament and let's look at some of the condemnation of Jesus Christ of hypocrisy. And he focuses specifically on the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes. And if we would, let's turn to the 15th chapter of Matthew, or I'll just read these to you if you prefer. We'll start in verse 3, Matthew 15, verse 3. And this is the confrontation. The Pharisees are asking the question in a very pointed fashion, how come your disciples aren't washing their hands, you know, before they eat? And it's a reference to, you know, ceremonial customs that were in place at the time, and there the Pharisees are upset in that they believe that this isn't the right thing to be done. Jesus Christ answers to him and says, "Why do you transgress the commandments of God because of your tradition?" So we've got a contrast here of, you know, this is you're taking something that is the commandment of men, you're elevating it to the same legal and moral authority as the commandment of God. What are you doing? You know, and then in verse 7 it says, "Hypocrites. You guys are hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying," verse 8 of Matthew, quoting Isaiah, "These people draw near to me with their mouth." The "me" in Isaiah is Jesus Christ in the New Testament. So he's quoting in that sense himself. "These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." That's an exquisite definition of hypocrisy. The pretense of being one thing when you're really something else. And Jesus Christ really did not like that and really took them to task over that. That you're appealing to me with your mouth, with the words that you're saying. You're honoring me with your lips, but your heart is something totally, totally different. This is a lie. This is a pretense. You're feigning sincerity here, but what's in your heart is diametrically opposite to what's coming out of your mouth. And concluding in verse 9, it says, "In vain they worship me." Again, Jesus Christ. "In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." And that's where the rubber hit the road with the Pharisees' position. They elevated traditions and different laws and regulations that they came up with over an extended period of time to the level of or beyond the Ten Commandments. Let's go to Matthew, maybe a page over or so, to Matthew 16 and read 11 and 12. Matthew chapter 16, verses 11 and 12. And this is a discussion about with the Jesus Christ and the disciples. And, you know, they're a lot of times with the disciples not at this point having God's Holy Spirit, but being with Jesus Christ, they looked at things from a physical perspective many times when Jesus Christ was speaking on about spiritual things. And these verses reflect that. 16, 11, and 12. "How is it you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread?" That's Jesus Christ asking the question of the disciples. "But to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." That's what I'm talking about. Those traditions of men. These people are teaching as doctrines. The traditions of men. That's what I'm talking about as leaven, he says. "Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread." He's not talking about physical leavened bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The direct connection, in my opinion, back to Matthew 15 and verse 9. Doctrines of the commandments of men. Then he goes on in Matthew 23. In Matthew 23, in my opinion, if it's different, please, someone let me know. But this has, in my opinion, the greatest number of condemnations by Jesus Christ of hypocrisy in one place that I can find. And there's 8 different woes that he pronounces against the scribes and the Pharisees that we'll get to in a minute. But before he does that, before he goes through those 8 woes, he says this. He says in Matthew 23 and verse 2, "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." They're in an elevated position of leadership, of spiritual and leadership and responsibility in this society. They're sitting in Moses' seat. They're the successors to Moses in that sense. Verse 3, "Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, do it, but do not do according to their works." Interesting statement. They're correct in what they tell you, but don't look at their example. Their example is flawed. "For they say and do not do." There's that pretense there. There's that feigning. And then he goes on in the successive verses here. It says, "They bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but themselves will not move even their fingers, will not move them even with one of their fingers." verse 5. But all of their works they do to be seen by men. It's pretense again. It's feigned. It's about looks. It's not about substance. It's about form. It's not about the reality of substance. You know, they do their works to be seen by men, dropping down to 6, verse 6. They love the best places at the feast. You know, at feast. They like the best seats in the synagogue. It's a show. We're the rich and the famous, the important, the powerful in this society. We want to be recognized as such. We're the celebrities here in this culture. They love to be called rabbi, or teacher, to be recognized in this role of superiority. But then he tells them, don't you be called rabbi. You've got one who is the teacher, and that's Jesus Christ. And he says, basically, don't call people on earth your father. For you've just got one spiritual father. And again, the physical spiritual contrast there. You've got one spiritual father. And he is in heaven, as verse 9 says. And then he concludes with elucidating, here's what I want you to be. Here's how I want you to conduct yourself. He, in verse 11, he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. Verse 12, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. No pretense there. That is substance. That's reality. That humility is unleavened in that sense. It's not puffed up. There's not a lot of air in there. It's compressed. It's genuine. It's the real thing. And then he goes through 8 different woes. And a woe can be defined as an expression of grief or regret or distress. And it can also be as an interjection of alas or something like that. Alas. And these he has this as a precursor to each one of these 8 woes. Don't have time to spend much time on those, but he goes through, you know, verse 13. It says, you shut up the kingdom of heaven. You know, by these setting up these doctrines, you know, you're describing as doctrines the commandments of man. You're elevating all of these regulations and things, you know, that you shut up the kingdom of heaven. You can't go in yourselves, and you don't permit anybody else to, or you don't allow anybody else to either. In verse 14, he says, you know, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, you devour widows' houses. And the one thing that we all get from reading in various places in both the Old and New Testament, it's God has a special place in his heart for widows and the orphans and the fatherless. It's a special place, so you want to be very careful about how you treat widows, because you're not dealing with just a person who lacks, in many cases, the capacity to respond to you, but you have God on their side, that if you mistreat them, then you are accountable for those actions to God. That's not a place that I want to be if I can help it. I don't want to be, in that sense, crossways with God the Father, with Jesus Christ, in how widows are treated. And he takes them to task on that. And he uses the word there in 14, for a pretense you make long prayers. You're acting like you are so spiritual, but it's just a sham. It's a pretense. You're not really like that, but that's what you project. That's what you profess. You know, down in verse 16, he says, you're blind guides. And then he goes through some very detailed things. You know, their oaths were focused on minutiae. You know, he basically says, you've lost sight of the significance of the altar. You've lost sight of the significance of the temple and whose temple it is. You're down there worried about whether it's the gold, the gift on the altar, or whether it's the gold or it's something else. And he's taking them to task for all of these regulations that they had at play at that point. You know, down in 23, he says, you know, whoa, you pay tithes on all of these little things. I mean, you've got tiny little seeds, and you're divvying that up so that you correctly and accurately tithe on that. But you're omitting justice or judgment, mercy, and faith. You're overlooking the things that really matter. But you ought to tithe. He's saying, you know, I'm not saying tithing is done away, but you got to focus on both of these things, not just on seed tithing on piles of seed, but you've got to get your eyes up out of the weeds, so to speak, and focus on truly what is important, and that is justice, mercy, and faith. I think some of that's a reference back to, don't forget how you're treating these widows. Were you merciful or not, or were you ruthless? The widows couldn't do really anything against them because of the authority and the power that they had. You know, he tells them in 25, you know, you guys are worried about the dishes. You're cleaning these receptacles inside and outside. But inside, you're like whitewashed tombs. They're pretty to see, but inside they're bones. You know, you have human remains that are on the inside, but the outside looks really pretty. You know, and that's that contrast. It's the pretension, the feigning of being one way, but truly being a different way. And in your heart, you're not that. You're professing to be something that you're not. It says, you appear to, in 27, it said, you appear to be righteous to men, but you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. You're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Passover is about 11 weeks away. I happened to be outside last night taking the dog out, and you can see that just beautiful little sliver of a new moon, and I'm not sure if that's actually the new moon last night or if we're a couple of days into it. But, you know, we're going to see that a couple more times, and, you know, the third time is going to be the start of the sacred year, and then Passover will be just 2 weeks after that. As we begin the preparation process of self-examination in preparation to take the Passover, let us look for the leaven of hypocrisy in our lives. Let's look at our lives for evidence of our actions not being consistent with our words and what is in our heart. And I think that's the one thing that we can do as we self-examine, as we examine ourselves, that we have a whole lot better idea of what's in our heart than even perhaps our spouses do. And they're the most likely the closest relationship that we have. But we can look at ourselves, we can look and see, you know, is there this leaven of hypocrisy in my life, in what I espouse to believe, what I profess to believe, and the results of that? Are those consistent with one another? Do my actions, are those consistent with my words and what is in my heart? And let's strive to put hypocrisy out of our lives.